This is really a story about two characters, a tale of two persons, or maybe two types of persons. The first is the scribe. And you heard how the scribe was depicted. The scribe wears long robes, loves to be greeted with honor at the door of the sanctuary, loves to have the first place in line at the potluck dinners, loves to have the best seat in the house when it comes to... This is getting a little personal. And yet, the scribe, Jesus says, devours widows' houses, forecloses on these widows so that they're on the street. They have no place to go. And at the same time, prays long, wonderful prayers to show people how religious they are. Not a very good depiction. And then we shift, and Jesus and his friends are watching, as I just told the children, people bringing their gifts to the temple. And the idea was that you would offer a tenth, a tithe of what you had to the temple. In this case, they're describing money, but it also included olive oil, grapes, wheat, a tenth of what you had to offer you brought to the temple. And that was the biblical standard. So many people were bringing maybe a tenth, maybe even more than a tenth. And these were pretty large sums of money. And then a widow. Jesus doesn't say if this widow is one of those widows who has been foreclosed on. But she comes and she puts in the tiniest coin available to her. And Jesus astonishes everyone around him by saying that she has given more than all the rest put together. Because she has given everything she has to live on. That's the way he describes it. She has no one to depend on. She has no money to depend on. She has nothing in this world to depend on except God. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that this is not just Jesus teaching a moral lesson about giving. Because you see, all of this takes place just before Jesus begins to make his journey into Jerusalem and make that week-long trek toward trial and crucifixion and the tomb. So this is on Jesus' mind. What he might face when he reaches Jerusalem is on his mind. And I'm going to suggest to you that these two stories are mirrors that are held up to Jesus about his options. Because a lot of people want him to be the scribe. After all, he's the Messiah, they believe. He should wear long robes. He should be given honor. He should be given a place of precedence. He should be given the highest seat in the synagogue. Now, of course, Jesus as Messiah would not devour widows' homes, would not be hypocritical that while he was devouring their homes, he was praying long prayers. Of course not. He would be the Messiah. He would be the kind of scribe that scribes are supposed to be. My guess is everybody sitting around him had that image in their mind. And then Jesus sees the widow. And while everybody else is giving more than she, because they have so much more than she does, she comes and she takes everything she has and she gives it. And Jesus sees himself. That is what is going to be required of him. When he goes into the city, he's not going to be able to settle for just a part, a tenth. No. He's going to have to offer not only all he has to live on, but his very life itself. I'm going to suggest to you that Jesus sees himself in that widow. A little bit earlier in Luke, he had told another story about a widow. This widow goes to a judge, and this judge does not care for God's opinion, does not care for human opinions, and yet this widow, persistently comes again and again and again until she gets justice. Jesus is not that widow. Oh, he'll go before a judge. And he'll go before a judge who does not respect divine opinion or human opinion, except for, of course, the emperor's opinion. He'll go before Pontius Pilate, but he won't get justice. In fact, what he will suffer is a grave and horrible injustice. He will be required not only to give what he lives on, he will be required to give his entire being to this thing that God is doing in the world. And aren't we glad he did? We talk about giving and gifts, and that's our theme now. We've been going through all of our membership vows, right? Prayers, presence, gifts, service, and witness. We're in the middle of gifts here in Epiphany. And when we talk about gifts, we often think about money. And the biblical standard, of course, is a tithe. It's a tenth, however you figure that. We United Methodists figure that a little differently because our average giving is about 3.5%, not 10. But we were never real good at math anyway. But I'm going to suggest to you that in this story, what God is demanding is not a tenth. God is not demanding 50% or 75%. God wants 100% of us, not just our stuff. God doesn't need more stuff. Us. And the question is, can we, who were given birth by God, who breathed into us the breath of life, who gives us every breath as a gift, can we offer back to God all that we have to live on, all that is our life, so that it can be used in some way or another? That, it seems to me, is the question. That would be following the example of Jesus. Now, this past week, I had the opportunity to be in a couple of annual conference meetings that are called strategic mapping. I've been in meetings like that before over the past 38 years, lots of them. They went by different names, but they all had the same purpose, and that was to try to plan and see what we needed to do within the annual conference. I actually think these may do some good. These may actually make a difference. But while I was sitting there listening to the person leading it, Gil Rendell, a thought hit me. I haven't even shared this with the staff. I'm going to share it with you first. The thought was, what if instead of treating these membership vows, prayers, presence, gifts, service, and witness, as membership vows, as if we were some kind of club, and when you join the club, you're going to support the club, because after all, that's what we say, isn't it? We say, will you support the United Methodist Church and this congregation with your prayers, presence, gifts, service, and witness? What if instead those became missional vows? And the church became the place where we come to practice those, to learn them, to practice them, to have our gifts named, to have our gifts cultivated. But they prepare us to go out and share those with the world. A life so saturated with prayer that it invades our business meeting and how we respond to those other persons there. A life so saturated with prayer that in the classroom you don't have to make kids pray. Your presence there is prayer. It is God's presence because you have experienced God's presence. I once was touring a school with a principal. It was a public school. He said, you know my definition of a Christian school? I was a little surprised. I said, no, what is it? He said, a school where every single child knows that they're loved. That's the presence of God, right there. Right there. What if we took this out into the world? What if we discovered our gifts here, cultivated our gifts here, and then shared them not just with the church, but out there? What if when we talked about service, we weren't just talking about serving on committees, as important as that may be. We're not just talking about serving on programs that the church has planned. We're talking about serving in all aspects and walks of life. And I know many of you already do this. I don't know if you think of it as ministry. It is. It's service to God. What if when we witness, we don't just tell our story to someone else in a Sunday school class, but when someone is feeling entirely bereft of God, we simply tell them a story of a time when God has been present for us, in the hopes that it will help God be present for them. Because you see, it doesn't say God so loved the church. It says God so loved the world. The church is perhaps the only institution that does not exist for itself. We exist for the sake of those who don't come. We exist for the sake of those who aren't a part of the club. We exist for the sake of those who would reject us. Some because they've been rejected by us. Others because when they hear Christians represented on television, they don't want anything to do with them. Frankly, I don't either most of the time. But what if these were missional vows? What if this was our training ground for our ministry in the world, taking it to the street? Would we be able to offer all of who we are in that? Now, we say here that our vision is to be the loving light of Christ in the world, connecting people to God and their neighbor, connecting them to the deepest part of their selves, so that lives and communities can be transformed. That's what we say. Well, that's not going to happen with us just sitting here, folks. It's going to happen when these vows become missional vows and get taken out of here. Now, quite frankly, it's scary to share your gifts, isn't it? You just ask some of these youngsters who are up here singing. Just ask some of these youngsters who are up here singing. I had the privilege of working with the retreat and the chancel choir yesterday. I didn't sing, you'll be glad to know. But one of the things we talked about was the risks you take when you give your gifts, when you offer your gifts. One of those risks is that it won't work out the way you hope it will. I think that fear that even though everything was perfect in rehearsal, when you finally were here singing in worship, your voice cracked. You went sharp or flat. Even though you practiced that sermon again and again and again, and you had it down pat, you got right to the end and your mind went blank completely. It happens. A part of our fear is that we won't offer our gifts in the way that we hope we can. Another risk is that people might reject our gifts. It happens. They say, I don't like that kind of music. Or, that preacher doesn't agree with my particular opinion on some political or social or religious issue, so I just reject it. It happens. When you offer your gifts in the world, it's very likely that much of the time it won't work out as well as you think or hope, and much of the time those gifts will be rejected. Look at Jesus. See what happened to him. But there's a third risk, and that is the risk that by offering your gifts without fear, lives and communities will be transformed. That's what we're called to do. Now, we can't do it alone. We do it as part of a community. We do it in the presence of God. But that's what we're called to do, to share those gifts, whether they work out the way we want to or not, whether they're accepted or not, in the hope that, in some way, lives will be transformed. Now, for the past couple of Sunday afternoons, we have had a group that meets at 4 o'clock here studying the works of C.S. Lewis, specifically the Chronicles of Narnia. Many of you will know these. Last week we did The Magician's Nephew. This week we're working on probably the best known of these books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Many of you will know this story. Spoiler alert, I will probably wreck it for those of you who don't, but believe me, once you read it, you'll recognize the story anyway. There are 4 children, 2 brothers and 2 sisters, who walk through a wardrobe into a land called Narnia. The land is ruled by an evil witch who is beautiful and powerful, and in it for herself completely. In this land, it is always winter and never Christmas, if you can imagine. Is there anything worse? These children walk through that wardrobe and into this world, and they meet a variety of people and animals along the way. But in the midst of that, one of the brothers, Edmund, betrays the other 3 to the witch, goes over to the dark side. There's a lion named Aslan, who is the true ruler of Narnia. When he comes, the rivers begin to melt. The snow begins to melt. The grass is seen again. It begins to become spring. And in the confrontation between Aslan and the witch tells Aslan that he has to allow her to kill Edmund because all those who betray belong to her. That's part of the deep magic that was around from the beginning of the world, we're told. She has the right to take the life of those who have betrayed others. But Aslan takes her aside and makes a special deal. In place of her killing Edmund, Aslan offers himself up. And so, there he is, tied to the stone table, muzzled, his mane cut off, humiliated. And in the final conversation before she kills Aslan, the witch reminds him that now he has no power. She can kill him, and then she can kill Edmund if she wants to. And so she does kill Aslan. But the sisters, Susan and Lucy, come back, and they find that he is not dead when they return. They help to unbind him, and he explains a little bit about what happened, because they don't understand this at all. Let me read you what he says. They ask what it means. He said, "It means that though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still that she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back, into the stillness and darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim, who has committed no treachery, was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack, and death itself would start working backward." I'm here to tell you that death has started working backward. We don't have to be afraid. We don't have to be afraid of our gifts not being good enough. We don't have to be afraid of our gifts being rejected. All we have to do is offer them. Because you see, we don't offer them alone. They are gifts from God. And any gift from God offered in love holds the possibility of transforming lives and communities, which, after all, is what we say we're about. It's what we say we're going to do. Now, will we do it?